Okay, we are live again. Hello, welcome to Fearless Thought. I am Jamie Wilkes, and our guest today is an elite athlete, an ultramarathon runner who is currently targeting the 100-kilometer ultramarathon world record time with a view to inspiring the next generation of runners and athletes all over the world. He is with Team England, has been with Team Great Britain, is a Nike athlete. Mr. Lee Grantham, welcome.
Thanks very much, mate. Good to be here.
Good man. Lee is somewhat of a maverick. And whilst most of us, including myself, think of running, especially long distance running, as a less than attractive spectator sport, Lee's bringing a ton of character to the sport, which is quite refreshing. So I'm keen to delve into some controversial sporting character topics today, looking at doping in sport, racism, the gender debate in relation to sport, touch on some aspects of corruption and in terms of what you're seeing at the moment. So some big topics, but before I get into it, Lee, I've seen you racing downhill, no helmet, looks like you're going 70 kilometers an hour, flying past cars. I got to ask, how many people do you piss off on a daily basis on your bike?
Well, you know what, it's a funny, do you mean running there, running at 70 kilometers an hour, cycling at 70 kilometers an hour? I mean, obviously, I don't wear a helmet, and I use the bike as, within ultra running, you have to do a portion of the work. In my opinion, you have to do a portion of the work on the bike. So I love the bike from being a kid. I remember my first BMX, my first mountain bike, and playing, being completely free, and reverse charge calling your mom because your dad would absolutely batter you from like 50 miles away saying it's raining, you know, come and pick me up. But I suppose the funny thing about that is, you know, there's always this argument between, and people think that the argument is between drivers and cyclists when it's actually not. And my opinion on it is the argument really is the typical argument in society between inconsiderate people and considerate people. So to answer the question, I don't piss off a lot of people. They may get sort of in places where it's, you're supposed to wear a helmet. They may be like, yeah, mate, you're supposed to wear a helmet or whatever, you know, what are you doing? But 20 years ago, you didn't need to wear a helmet. So, and I think if you just pottering around at slow pace, and you know what you're doing as well, then you're completely fine. But I'm also just as against some cyclists as I am. So you know, there's obviously bad drivers and there's bad cyclists. So when you've got the law in a country, you can ride two abreast, like two people side by side, and there's a big queue of cars. I think that's inconsiderate on the cyclist part. I think they should move single file, let the cars pass, because the biggest thing that I don't like is people who waste people's time. So I would say not so many, not as many as you may think.
How fast are you going? Because I've seen your videos and it doesn't look like you're going, you know, at a reasonable pace. It looks like you're flying, pal. Like, how fast are you going?
I'm really light, yeah? So with that, you can't sort of pick up much momentum going downhill. So the fastest I've ever been is just over 100 kilometers an hour. But
on a push bike?
On a push bike going downhill, yeah. And it's an amazing feeling. Wow. But then on the flat, you're sort of doing 30 to 35 kilometers an hour. But this is another thing, and it's the same with drivers. There's a thing, it's one thing passing your test and learning to drive. It's another thing actually learning to drive on your own and being completely aware of everything that goes on around you. And I see cyclists and drivers have, I've just seen an accident right now, 30 minutes ago.
How often are you in accidents, like at that pace? Because these are hilly terrain as well, right? This is not straight lines.
Yeah, so I'll finish this and I'll tell you about the accident. So you have to be totally aware, and you have to realize that you're a person wearing Lycra on a bicycle, right? against a one-ton, two-ton truck, car, whatever, right? You're going to lose no matter who's what the blame is, what the law is. It doesn't matter. So if you're the type of person that can sit in a hospital bed for 6 weeks and say, yes, but I was in the right and I was following the law, then fine, no worries. You could be that person, but I'm not that person. I'll be the person that sees something that's going to happen. It looks like it's going to happen. You've been in this situation enough. This guy's not really checked his mirror. And until you've seen somebody's eyeballs in a car, you've got to assume that they've not seen you. So, and also, what is the percentage of bicycles you see on the road, dependent on the place, obviously, compared to the drivers? So drivers, you've got to expect that they're not expecting you and you're invisible. You've got to ride like that, because otherwise you are the guy in the hospital bed. But I've had one serious accident, and that was it was coming downhill fast, and it was going for a record, so a KOM on Strava, and it was me and the lads who we sort of race against each other, and I hit a corner. There was a car overtaking another car coming up the hill, so he was in my lane. I had to avoid him. And then I couldn't control it, and I sort of tried to ride it up, so I didn't brake, and I went into the ditch hard and rolled over. And luckily, nothing broken, but just a lot of blood and time in the hospital, which is, it's just an inconvenience. But within within one day, I was back out running, and it was fine. I just needed a few stitches. That was all.
Lucky then, mate, really. If you only had the one accident at that pace, 100 kilometers an hour downhill, that's insane.
But you could say that, or you could say, well, maybe there's a reason that this person hasn't had as many accidents as your typical person, yeah? And that's because it's the same in the car. You know when you're driving along what's going on. You're driving along on the motorway, there's three lanes. People sit in the middle lane when they definitely should be on the slow lane, yeah, all the time. People are making these mistakes. Like, what are you actually doing there? Like, the other day, I was just running up the hill, and a guy overtook me to stop 30 meters in front of me at a red light. And I'm like, dude, you've put my life at risk, your life at risk, the person in the other lane at risk to stop at a red light a little bit longer. I'm just asking. I went to his window, not confrontational, but just said.
He had to win though, mate, obviously. He had to get there first.
That's the thing. And also, he'd just been overtaken by the guy in front of him. So probably his pride was dented. And I just went to his window and was like, what was going through your head when you just did that? I'm really interested. And he was like, you should be really on the road. You're like, well, I don't understand why you wanted to stop at the red light. But I find it funny. That's the thing. You can be angry about these things, but what's the point? You might as well try and find the humor in everything. So if somebody's going to do something ridiculous, it does. The only time it gets to me is when you're riding in a group, and I don't often ride in a group, for various reasons, but I don't often ride in a group. But when you do ride in a group and there's timid riders and a car goes past really close, the amount of times where I've seen somebody literally get to a coffee shop shaking and say, I'm not doing this ever again. And this is the last time I ride. That's not a nice thing to see.
It's those Strava segments, mate, though. Like maybe the dude that overtook you to get to that red light, maybe he was on a Strava segment. Those things really motivate people. It's insane, really, just those... maybe he was cheating.
Yeah,
maybe. I've seen a few dodgy times out there. So luckily, you've cut quite a controversial character at times in the running scene. I've seen you on the start line in what might be called banter engagement. I've seen some of your post-race interviews. How are you different to other runners in that respect? And why are you different? Is this on purpose, or is this just you being you?
Yeah, honestly, it's just me being me, and I think that's the key thing. Yeah, you need to have characters in sport, and the people that I look up to in sport are characters. But it's you can't sort of try and be somebody. You know, we see it in the UFC, we see it in boxing, where you've got somebody who's brilliant at it, like Conor McGregor, and then you get 20 other people trying to copy what he does. And it looks horrendous. And if you were that person's agent or manager, you'd just be like, just be yourself, dude, because you're embarrassing yourself. And so it's also, I suppose it's the same as lying, right? It's so nobody's intelligent enough to be a liar. So you can't act like that. And it's so less stressful just to be yourself. I just suppose part of it comes from typically runners and distance runners are introverted people. But also I came back to the sport after a gap in the sport for 10 years. So I've been in a different industry. And so I have a massive sense of appreciation. So when you see me on the start line, and for me, that's like, that's party time, because if the training's gone well and you're not injured, you're not carrying a niggle, that is the time when you should be enjoying it the most.
But everyone else looks so serious.
Yeah, everyone else is super anxious because they've been training for 3, 4, 5 months, for instance, if it's a marathon. Maybe their salary is dependent on this race. Maybe a sponsorship. Maybe their mortgage is dependent on this race. These are all extrinsic motivations, right? All my motivation is intrinsic. I do it because I love it. I would do it for free. I would do it if I had to still have a full-time job. So those intrinsic motivations consistently outperform extrinsic motivations. This is so much more powerful.
What's the most controversial thing you've done in terms of on the cycling scene? On the running scene?
Controversial.
Who have you pissed off?
When I first started getting competitive, I would think it would be a pretty fun thing to get into people's heads. I still think it is, but some people just crumble and then you feel like a bully. You're just trying to have a bit of banter. Like you would, if you're playing football, the other lads be in on it, right? So you'd just be like,
Or cricket, when you're sledging, the slips are giving you, an earful when you're facing the bowler.
Gamesmanship, right? And but then if you say to a runner and it's like 3 seconds before the gun's about to go, shoelace is undone, it's going to like, and you're like, oh fuck, it's I just ruined the guy's like life. But that's how it feels. So it is actually really easy. It's easy to say, oh, are you limping on your left leg? It looks if you're limping, in the day before the race. And then all of a sudden the guy's like, am I limping? I'm imbalanced on one side. But if you're solid mentally, which you should be, and the best runners are, then those things shouldn't affect you. It should actually put more fire in your belly to perform better, which is what it does to me. But nothing outrageous, but just regular fun. Also you're super enthusiastic before, during, and after the race as well. Like you're full of endorphins and it's just a good time to have fun.
So, how important do you think character is in terms of running? So when you look at some sports, there are standout characters, especially in a lot of the team sports. And then on the individual front, you've got people like Muhammad Ali and like you just mentioned, Conor McGregor. And on an individual sport level, how important is character to the appeal of that sport? I think that's the question. Like I said to you before, and I know we talked before we went live, but I always found watching running marathons fucking boring. I'm not going to lie. Like nobody really watches marathons on TV or live. Like it's small groups or it's the grandstand finish, or you watch the last 10 minutes of a race, and unless you're really, really, really into it, it doesn't capture that mass audience. Okay. Would you agree with that, first of all?
100%, yeah. And I'm a diehard athletics fan. And but even if it's the Olympic final, maybe the Olympic final, I watched the 10,000 meter, 25 laps of a 400 meter track, right? That is going to be decided in the last two laps. A flat stage of the Tour de France is going to be decided in the last 500 to 800 meters. So why would you tune in for 3 hours when you know it's going to be decided in the last literally 40 seconds? So it's so important to have characters in sport. And, snooker is a perfect example because, I'm mates with Ronnie O'Sullivan and I don't just watch him because he's become a friend. He became a friend because of that, because I won't watch snooker unless Ronnie's playing. And there's probably other sports like that where you would maybe the same as in boxing for some fans. I'm not watching unless Floyd's fighting or Muhammad Ali's fighting or Tyson's fighting or something. It's just the not what he does or his record, which is super impressive. It's the way that he does it. And for me, that is sport. That is playfulness. And that is what inspires kids to pick up a cue and go down to the to try and emulate. Is that the word? Emulate?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, so yeah, that'll do. There'll be a few of them. So to inspire a kid to go down to a dark, dingy snooker pool room in order to try and emulate Ronnie O'Sullivan, for me, that is amazing. When I'm 37 years old. When I ride my bike, I still remember all the Tour de France watching Lance Armstrong. And when I ride my bike, when I'm out of the saddle, I'm thinking in my head, I'm him, yeah? When I'm like pushing it up a mountain, I'm trying to beat my previous record, I'm thinking in my head, I'm Lance Armstrong. I don't care about what's happened since. You can't tell me. I've done interviews in the past where people say, oh, you know, for bigger magazines where it's like, and they ask you who are your heroes and you list certain people. And one of them is always Lance Armstrong. And they've said, oh, do you mind if we leave that out? I'm like, why? And it's like, well, because of, you know, what we found out in the last 8 years since 2000. And it's like, well, no, because that's literally taking my childhood away from me. I grew up watching cycling and loving the battles with him and Pantani, with him and like various other people. And it's just, for me, cycling is a beautiful sport, and it can be boring like running can be to watch. So we need characters and we need to do something else to make it more exciting. Simple as that.
Look, I kind of, that story you just told there about the publisher or whoever it was asking to omit that answer about Lance Armstrong, I kind of get it. As somebody who is not, I'm not a cyclist or a runner, okay? But I'm massively into sport and play other sports. I've been following other sports all my life. So whenever there's an aspect of somebody who has cheated, it automatically, for me, just discredits that individual. Like there is a blot on the copybook. There's a question mark over the validity, over the, see what I mean? So the only time, I guess, you're from the inside, I guess, in terms of on that sport in particular, or in and around the similar sports. So why do you not see it, like from my perspective, where Lance is a controversial character, a polarizing character? It seems to me that he gets most of his support from within the realms of athletics and the sport itself. And yeah. And yet your average Joe like me, who's been on the outside, who may have watched a few Tour de France's or appreciated his success just from a sporting achievement perspective, yet for me feels tarnished.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that's something within a sport that a lot of people struggle with, outside, inside. Like, I'm not a big fan of golf, playing or watching. Can't play it, can't hit a ball. And watching looks like literally watching paint dry, right? But when I watched the documentary about Seve Ballesteros, that brought me to tears. Like, and to sort of run through a couple of hours, 90-minute documentary film, for that's not a sport story. That's a life story, right? Yeah. And so for me, I've read all the accounts of what happened in those tarnished years, if you want to put it that way, in cycling. And it's not good. It's definitely not good to have to come to the sport and make a decision. Either you're on board and you're in systematic doping within the team or individual or part of your country, or you go home and you've already forfeited your education to get to where you were. So there's nothing really left for you. So I don't like the fact that kids at 20 years old, whatever, had to make that decision. I think it's a bad thing. And I think the sport is improving, hopefully. And but if you ask me why, it's because I've read everything that was going on at the time. And I'm pretty sure it was rife amongst
That's my next question. Like, is it the fact that people, especially from within the sport, accept that whilst, yes, he was found guilty, and yes, he's obviously a massive issue there, on the doping front, it was so widespread that actually everyone was doing it. So even though he was doping, so was everybody else. Therefore, they were still all on pretty much an even keel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because that logically makes sense to me. If you were to say, look, yes, fine, he was caught doping, but then the top 20% or more, maybe all of the athletes, they were all doping, they were all at it, and there's evidence for all of that, etc.
Yeah.
Therefore, it was still an even keel because everyone was still playing the same games, tweaking with their engines, tweaking with the doping, tweaking with the training. It was still just another facet of performance, like in F1, you know, the whole driver versus the engine debate. Similar thing there, I guess, where the most advanced at tech, the most advanced mechanics, the biggest budgets do better at producing a stronger, faster car. I guess that can be applied in doping, where the more advanced scientists, the more advanced physicians, the more investment into that side of it produced the better and faster person through doping.
Exactly that. And so whilst we think sort of it created an even field because everybody's allowed to, you've obviously got different levels. And depending on how much your team had, depending on whether your team was on board with that sort of stuff, depending on whether your doctor was completely on board, there was obviously people doing it to different levels. So money played a big part. And so there was a point when having the best doctor was a huge sign whether you were going to win the Tour de France, big events or not. But still, having said that, some people will say, oh, it wasn't the cheating because everybody was cheating, but it was more the bullying, right, with Lance. And you could...
Jordan.
For me, like, just an alpha male being an alpha male, right? So you have that in school. Growing up, you had that in school. There's the cock of your year, and, you know... the cock of your year, and we're in a time now where you can actually disrespect somebody online and you don't get beat up for it, right? But we grew up in a time when you probably wouldn't say anything bad to the cock of your year because he's going to batter you, right? And there'd be consequences for your actions. So now we're moving away from that. But what I mean in terms of that is I think what happens is that, first of all, Lance is an alpha male, right? But then when you lie for the first time, and then you have to continue lying, because you can't just tell, and he says this as well, you can't just tell one person, oh, by the way, I'll give you a good interview, actually, I'm doing this. And then it's completely, just you keep it to yourself, though. Once you lie, you don't just bring down your own career, you bring down everybody else's career. So once you tell, you come out and tell the truth, you bring down, and there's probably like hundreds of people riding on his...
House of cards.
Exactly, yeah, exactly that. So,
Is it still going on? Is it still going on, Lee? I mean, how widespread is doping now?
I'm not in a sport well enough to know that, but I think this is my thought. This is my opinion, yeah? With all the fucking disclaimers you need, yeah? But I would say in sport, the more money in the sport, the more chances that people are pushing boundaries, pushing into the grey areas, or in, you know, as I recently heard, leaning over into the grey, leaning over the fence as possible.
The more there's riding on it, the more likely there is to be some foul play of some kind.
Yeah, because you have to remember that there's the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, yeah, and then each individual country has its own. And they have a budget, and then you've got huge sponsors involved, huge companies involved that have a 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times their budget, right? So scientists not be ahead of the game in terms of that? I think it will change. I think it will change because what will happen is we're going to get to a point where we probably already have, I'm probably being naive here, probably got to a point where we're looking at genetic doping, yeah? So then you would think, okay, it's impossible to detect that. But they're working on that right now so that we would know if somebody puts an alien substance into their body or tries to alter the makeup of their body, you're going to know about it because you will not only, like you have right now, you have the biological passport, but you have you literally know that person's DNA. So impossible to I and again, I'm not a scientist, mate, but I think we're moving towards a point where it becomes a more even platform. And then sport gets exciting. I think, yeah.
Okay, so two things there. You mentioned about, just want to clarify. So the first point was that WADA, the Anti-Doping Agency, they have a certain level of budget that goes so far, which means they could afford a certain standard of scientist, a certain standard of chemist, a certain standard of whatever that they need as part of their team. But the sponsors and the teams, not naming any names, which are raking in billions from the sports, their budgets are exponentially bigger than WADA. Therefore, they should be able to afford and pay the more advanced scientists and the more advanced chemists and so on and so forth. That's the theory.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
I've never thought of it like that before.
I guess it makes complete logic sense. So why wouldn't that happen? Money talks, right?
Yeah, money talks. And then you know, cycling is always thrown under the bus because it has such a tainted record right from the beginning. Right from the beginning, people were doing crazy things to cheat. Like, I think I told you this before, but a car would drive in front of them with a fishing line and with a cork on the end, and the guy would be biting the cork and being pulled along by this car. And, you know, no television back then, you'd get away with it. So
that's pretty brash though, isn't it? Just like literally getting an invisible lift up a hill.
There was a guy a few years ago up in the northeast of England who came third in a half marathon or something. And afterwards, it was in the paper, the podium, and a bus driver said, "Hold on a minute, you got on my bus." So you got like, this is the interesting thing for me, the psychology of doping and the psychology of cheating. Like, how does that guy climb onto third spot on the podium? He didn't even win. He took the bus and didn't even win. That would be embarrassing. But then, how does he climb onto the and be like, yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'd like to thank my family and my grandpa. And how does that go on in somebody's head? So that's also really fascinating for me. But it's easy to see that obviously money would help, but also cheats don't just get incentivized by money. It's also status and winning, being local champions. There's all sorts of crazy stories that go on. And also the culture of the company matters a lot as to whether you're going to sort of cross the line or not. Because you can imagine that the stakes are much higher for somebody like a kid born in London who has plenty of other options to do other things, has a full education, to somebody born in Kenya who's like genetically gifted in the marathon, maybe not top, but able to win a major city marathon and earn a lifetime wage, or he has the opportunity to work on his farm for $20 to $40 a month and hope that there's rain every season in order to harvest a crop. So I think, you know, we have to, and this is one of the things I spoke to somebody in sport ethics about, is what is the fallout? If you get, a guy from London who's never known anything else apart from athletics, high school, college, gone to scholarship in America, then gets found to be a cheat, is there a safety net there to stop the guy? Because that's a suicide case waiting to happen, as far as I would be able to see it. You'd need to probably change your name, because you'd be branded forever. You cheated. You did something in order to get away. So
where do we stop though? So you mentioned a minute ago about genetic doping.
Mm.
Okay. What can you just give me a light? I mean, it sounds like a very intense topic. What is that? Is that happening now? Is that something that is that the future of doping?
Yeah,
I actually know of some rumors around a certain stable reproducing genetically modified horses and selling them all over the world to different stables, and so I heard of that, but. Mm. Unconfirmed, like, you know, this is just something that I heard in conversation quite recently. So, you know, and obviously with genetics, we can genetically modify many things. Mm. And we've cloned animals apparently over the years. So how does this apply to sport? How does this apply to genetic doping, as you call it?
Yeah, well, again, you know, I'm not an expert in this field, but, you know, you've probably
what's
heard
the theory?
You've probably heard of stem cell therapy and stuff like
that,
right?
Yeah.
So you could, and you've heard of probably the rumors around and the theories around, you can literally, if you want to test your baby, you can go pick eye color, you can pick height, you can pick this, you can, you know, it's crazy, right?
Actually, yeah, I've actually experienced that firsthand with a geneticist with our first kid, when we had some problems during pregnancy, and we sat there with a geneticist, and they basically told us we could select so many things now. It's crazy. Yeah.
So then I think, you know, that would be, you'd obviously have super children being born. Can we have like a same Bolt speed as well as Eliud Kipchoge's endurance? That would be pretty useful. So stuff like that. And again, I don't know exactly, but you can modify what you have. You can modify what you have, apparently.
So changing genetic code somehow. But that has to happen before creation. I don't think you can do that retrospectively.
The rumors are you can, yeah, but I'm talking outside my...
Sure. Yep. I'll try and find a geneticist for my next chat. Here's one. Lionel Messi. It mm-hmm. was rumored, and again, rumors, these are unproven stories as far as I'm concerned, but it was rumored that he was so small as a kid, but so naturally gifted as a footballer, that he was given courses of things like human growth hormone. Again, unconfirmed, but I think that was what was referenced. He was given human growth hormone over a prolonged period, I'm talking years, to get him to a level of physical strength and speed to be able to compete with men because he was so tiny, so slight. That's an interesting one because he's gone on to become one of the greatest footballers of all time. He's had about 2 injuries in 20 years, plays 60 to 70 games a season, scoring 50 goals a season, every season, for a decade or more. It's just absolutely insane. I mean, Ronaldo's obviously up there, very similar in terms of performance, but it's just interesting that Messi has his background of prolonged periods of taking some kind of enhancement, whether it was human growth hormone or whatever it was back in the 90s when he was a kid. But interesting one. Maybe, I'm not sure of the impact of that, but this is obviously happening.
You obviously then got a question. If you're taking stuff, how long does it stay in your body? And is there long-term effects of it, long-term benefits of having it in your system from being a young age, right? So there was a study, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, where he did a sector of the NBA and saw that a huge proportion of the players were obviously really tall, really physically well-built, and had grown up in poor areas where their main staple of the diet was cheap fried chicken, right? And within that fried chicken was steroids were injected. So indirectly, these kids were getting all these hormones and steroids and things like that. And, you know, you've got like mum's 5'4", dad's 5'6", the son is 9'12" or something. Yeah, it's just insane. But, you know, again, it's, I don't know, it's funny, but, you know, what can you say? Have you ever met anybody really tall, like insanely tall?
No, but my youngest kid is 140% or 125 percentile on the growth chart, which means he's going to end up being 6'6".
Oh, wow.
The only person I've met really, really tall is... A rugby league football player, is a friend of mine here, Wayne McDonald, and he's huge. He's pushing 7 foot. It's ridiculous.
I remember rocking up to an apartment for a barbecue. Me and my girlfriend at the time, like I suppose 10 years ago, and she's like, right, he's a Swedish handball player, plays for Barcelona, right? Going meeting him and his girlfriend. She's like, he's really tall. Don't say anything. Really tall. Don't say anything. He doesn't like it. Really tall. Okay, yeah, don't worry. Fuck, I've met people before, you know. I know how to handle social situations. He opened the door. I was like, fucking hell, what the? And she's like, I told you not to say anything. I was like, Jesus Christ, you live in a grow bag. You're like, what's the weather like up there? All the dad jokes. He was ridiculously big. And you're just like, it's just like almost like a different species.
Yeah. Look, it's happening more and more, I think, as well, isn't it? What are the best sports for tall people? Basketball, obviously. What about
ball,
athletics?
Basketball, long jump, triple jump. I think sprinting is pretty good. Like David Rudisha, who runs the 800 meters, was like a really tall Kenyan, which was one of their first tall people. Yeah. You have the famous case, Julius, a Kenyan guy who learned how to, because obviously they broke onto the scene, Kenyans, with loads of distance runners and were brilliant at that genetically. But then they had a guy who was a bit tubby, a bit bigger, and he learned how to throw the javelin on YouTube and then became like, I think he became world champion, if not like Commonwealth champion or something.
You mentioned genetics there. So in your game, if you were to ask nine times out of 10, people would answer that if you were to think of the famous runners, who would they be? And they would probably name you 99 of 100 African runners. How big a part does genetics play in your sport, and how do you bridge the gap?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know what? I think it obviously plays a huge part, right? And all the studies they've done on East Africans, some people thought it was because they were born at altitude, they've always lived at altitude. Some people said it was because they ran to school every day because the nearest school was 10 kilometers away. Some people said because the amount of them versus the amount that they need to win races is huge. So you've got these huge pockets of great runners who egg each other on. When it actually comes down to it, the best study I've seen is to do with the volume of the lower leg and the amount of energy that the lower leg takes, and therefore the efficiency, the economic.
The volume of the lower leg.
The volume of the lower leg. So if you put
in terms of mass.
Yes, yes. So if you look at your calves are obviously massive, right? Mine are pretty big for runners. But actually, I'm really skinny, yeah? When I go next to a Kenyan guy, it's just like, it's a different type of leg, yeah? And so more efficient.
What do you mean?
Just a lot skinnier. The calf is much higher on the leg. And so it takes a lot more, the further away you get from the heart, the harder it is to get blood, right? So the less blood, less oxygen that needs in order to propel yourself forward, the more economical you're going to be. So that's apparently 10% more efficient. Yeah.
So the calf is higher on the leg, therefore it's closer to the heart, therefore it gets blood.
I think it's a bit more complicated.
To understand.
It's just two centimeters higher, so it's a lot easier to get blood to it. No, it's because it's just more efficient because there's less volume, there's less muscle there.
How does that happen? Is that a genetic thing? Is that an environmental thing?
Yeah, genetic. And then you could go back, and I'm sure there's something like persistence hunting and things like that that left Africa a lot later than it left the developed world, right?
Okay. So the hunter-gatherer lifestyle was still prevalent up until quite recently. In fact, it's still quite prevalent in many parts of it.
I'll tell you the story, right? So I just did something for Nike, right? And I'm in a cab on the way from London to wherever, one of the faraway airports. And I meet a Somalian guy who went to school with a footballer from Holland who played for Arsenal. You'd be able to tell me who he is.
Van Persie?
Van Persie, yeah. I don't know football. Yeah, so it's Van Persie, right? So he went to school with Van Persie, and he was talking about other players there. But this guy was from Somalia. He was like, you're running. Okay, yeah. Do you know Mo Farah? And he told me that Mo Farah wasn't anywhere near the fastest guy in the village. It was just that he had an opportunity to come to Britain, right? And still, in his village back home, if you're a guy and you want to date a girl, and you know, you can't just date, you don't just date several girls and then you date with the intention of marrying, right? If you want to date, you have to go to the dad, ask for his permission, and bring him a lion's head. This still goes on with some, and you can't shoot it, you have to creep up on it, tire it out, and get it with a spear. This is still happening today, apparently. I totally believe the guy as well.
Amazing.
Totally believe the guy. Yeah, I think I don't know. Animal lovers would have something to say about that. But if you're willing to creep up a lion.
Listen, it's very different when you're living in the wild with lions, right? If it's part of, you know. It's hunt or be hunted. I mean, it's okay for them, I think. But
imagine sitting down, though, with a dad. You'd be like, what is it? Ah, right. Yeah, I mean, she's hot, but she's not. Yeah, yeah. It's okay. No, she could be single. Yeah, absolutely not.
Maybe that's why Mo left.
Yeah.
So you've been obviously on Team GB. Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned Mo Farah there, which kind of brought this to mind. So you've had some involvement with British Athletics, and it'd be good to get your opinion on what's going on kind of behind the scenes, because it feels like there are certain favourite sports that they invest in. There are certain favourite athletes that they invest in. But just from an outsider's perspective, it doesn't feel like we're getting anywhere on the Olympic front in terms of performance. It seems to be pretty standard run-of-the-mill performance. We never seem to increase against the world powers. What's going on?
Well, if I don't know, if I ask you, when you watch the Olympics, what are you really watching? What do you really show up to watch when you turn on the television?
Mainly track.
Yeah, track and field.
Mainly track. Field for me. Mainly track. Okay. I like triple jump, high jump. I like long jump. Mm-hmm. But the sprints in particular and the hurdles, they for me are like the pinnacle. Mm-hmm. That's like when I remember back in the day, I'm thinking Linford Christie, Sally Gunnell. Mm-hmm. For me, track when in the 90s was massive, and that's what I tuned in for.
Yeah. So most people would say the same. And for me, it's the same. Track and field and seeing the Olympic Stadium, growing up watching Barcelona Olympics in 92, I think it was, watching Linford Christie win. That was like, wow, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And there are some other sports that is the pinnacle of their event. But the main sports we're looking at is track and field, cycling, track cycling mainly, and then swimming as well is a main one, right? But but there's also football Olympics, and you know, and it means much less. And there's other sort of combat sports and things like that where it means something. And anyway, these are the main things. And so, from the inside, I think British athletics is literally following a pattern that it's followed for about 40 years now. So we haven't improved for 35 to 40 years. And you could say, from what I found out, and I've dug on this a lot, we look at it the wrong way. And we look at it probably the same as we look at politics. We look at it with very short-term thinking. So instead of thinking, right, okay, where do we need to develop? Like, okay, within sort of four Olympic cycle, let's be there. We throw loads of money at the next Olympic cycle. So we fund athletes for 2 to 4 years and we say, get as quick as you can and try and win a medal for us. We only judge athletes if they have medal potential. So we only send people who have medal potential, which, when you're competing in a sprints against Jamaica and Black Americans, mainly, there's the odd outlier, but mainly it's those. And then within distance running, Kenyans, Eritreans, Ethiopians, Ugandans are so dominant, it's crazy. Then, okay, throwing events. We had Greg Rutherford, triple jumper. Now, I have my own thoughts on field. I grew up at a track and field club, and for me, it was all about distance running. I understood the sprints, understood the beauty of it, but for me, it's that things started at the 800, 1500, 5000, and the steeplechase and the 10,000. But I think we look at it too short-term thinking, and I think the reason we've not progressed is because we just throw a load of money at trying to make people into superstars at the wrong stage. We should be putting that money into grassroots sports, and specifically if we're talking about Olympics, specifically around track and field, swimming and cycling. That's what we should be doing.
Is it corrupt? Is the wealth distribution a problem?
I would say, you know, we know there's corruption in FIFA, right? I would say in athletics, it's pretty much no different. And, you know, there's a reason why it's exactly the same with the World Cup. Certain countries will bid for it. And then, what, really? You're going to give it to that country that has no stadiums? Okay. Nobody's interested in the sport?
On the bidding itself, there's obviously some dodgy dealings going on, like obviously was proven with FIFA hand over fist, I guess. But
yeah.
What about on a local level? So what about in the UK, there is going to be a certain number of funds that comes from taxpayer, from government, and then a certain number of funds from sponsors. Are there any other sources? Is there any private funders?
So there's a private funder and then National Lottery is the main funding for the National Olympic Lottery, cycle,
which is government really, because it's a government control thing, right?
Yeah, so, and the way it's distributed is based on our performance at the last Olympics. So depending on how many medals we got, then we can either keep the same amount of investments, keep the same funding, or that funding also goes to a ridiculous amount of administration staff, whether it's British Athletics, England Athletics, and we're talking about
what's the proportion? What's the balance between?
I'm not sure, but it's crazy. I mean, you could.
We should be able to find that out, right? You should be able to find that out. You should be able to understand. Okay, how much is going to athletes and actual infrastructure, and how much is going to bureaucracy?
Yeah, you should be, but the very, like, probably football as well, FIFA, they're very, very good at hiding data. So, for example, like one of the KPIs for England Athletics, and obviously there's Welsh Athletics, Irish Athletics, Scottish Athletics, one of their KPIs was to increase participation within running. So they just bolted on the Parkrun initiative and said, hey, look at all these people. And then it became, look how many runners we've got. But it's not how many runners you've got. You can't count somebody who run once a month as a runner. That's not a runner, that's just a person, right? So really what sport should be is activity for life, yeah? So with the purpose, whether you're gold medal at the Olympics or whether you run twice a week or whether you participate in something, regularly as a habit, really we want a healthier, more productive, more creative nation, right? And a happier nation through sport. That should be the main goal. And yes, you look at the Olympics and you say, wow, that's somebody in a Great Britain vest and they look and sound like me and therefore, but I think it's the wrong way to look at it. If you ask me about the proportion, I'd hazard a guess that it's a crazy, we'd probably be talking like 80-20 in terms of administration staff, CEOs, very, very ridiculously well-paid chief executives versus athletes.
Is it not a catch-22 though? So just playing devil's advocate. You mentioned there about, okay, a lot of money goes into, just before that last point, you talked about glorifying individuals and putting all our kind of eggs in the basket of making people feel like superstars. But do we not need that to inspire? Like, is that not part of the strategy? So we make a big deal out of these athletes to then go on and try and inspire more athletes? Or is that not the reason behind that?
This is another thing. It's like when we look at London 2012, you look at what impact that had on the economy, what impact that had on getting people into sport. And you can't put a return on investment figure on it, because you'd have to ask the nation, like, who was inspired by the Olympics? Were you inspired enough to actually take up a new sport? Were you inspired to take up a sport that you'd never done before? Were you inspired to do your sport more? It's really difficult to do. But still, you could say, of course, you know, wouldn't it be better to spend the amount of money that it costs to host the London 2012 Olympics? Or wouldn't it be better to spend that money on grassroots? Compared to spending it on something else, non-sport related, of course it's better to spend it on sport. But then we can be wiser with that money. And it's so clear. It's crazy how clear it is, because
what's clear? What's clear?
So for instance, London 2012 Olympics was the most expensive Olympics to date, $15 billion directly on the project, right? An Olympics is a mega project. So to take it on, to go through the bidding process and stuff like that, usually put a bid in, yeah? Usually that comes with a cost overrun. And we're only talking directly for the stadiums, direct transport to stadiums. And if you remember, London 2012 wasn't a case of new infrastructure and things like that. It was a lane available for taxis that would take athletes and stuff like that to stadiums, which wouldn't be a legacy afterwards. So we didn't have an infrastructure or anything like that. And there's a cost overrun. I think the average cost overrun for an Olympics since 1960 is 176%.
Oh, Jesus, that's huge.
So you've got these mega projects, and then they get into 4, 5, 6 years into it, and they're like, oh my God, we've bitten off more we can chew. So
is it a case of, okay, we've got these by the balls now. This city has committed to us. They can't back out because they've made promises left, right, and center. So 2 years in, X company is coming in, chucking an extra bill. Next company comes in, but beats up his bill. Oh, we didn't anticipate this problem. Here's another 10 million to fix it. Is that going on? That must be going on.
Both. Yeah, absolutely. Both. And also, it's initially a low bid, right?
How do you stop that, though? How do you stop this?
There is a program in place now, which, and Rio Olympics, seemed to be a step in the right direction, right? So they brought it right down. I can't remember the exact figure. I want to say 5.7 billion, right? But they brought it right down. And it was basically each Olympics, you're supposed to write, okay, what were the problems we had in that project? Why did it cost overrun? How can we fix them moving forward? And how can we make it a better project? But what you get is between countries and between continents, you get a competitive nature. Oh, we wanted our Olympics to be the best, so we're not going to give you all. And so you do have a sort of select team that moves around, but obviously, 4 years in between, this is an aging team, right? So there's only so many cycles you can work on.
Yeah.
But then if you compare that into putting it into grassroots, so we recently had, not so recently now, Don Valley Stadium, major stadium, athletic stadium in the northeast, in Don Valley in Sheffield, iconic stadium, not enough money to maintain it, so it had to be taken down. We had, even at my local club, you've got hundreds of members. Comes to winter, we've not got enough money to get new floodlights or to refurbish the floodlights. Yeah. So all of a sudden you've got a load of kids that should have been on the track training, but they're having to go out on the street lights to train. Yeah. So in terms of, if you're managing that size budget and you're managing the size of the budget that comes every year in order to fund the next Olympians, if you put that into grassroots sport, it's much easily managed, and you could say, right, that was the cost, that's what happened, and this was the result, this is what you got for your money. The return on investment for much more but smaller projects would be immense. Two more things. The main problem we've got is getting kids into sport, right? And then between under 15s and under 20s, there's a 95% drop off. So we already have them bought in. They already love the sport, but they're falling off for various reasons. Maybe they plateau and they stop to improve, and therefore they don't get excited by the sport anymore. Maybe they leave to go to university for positive reasons. Maybe they join another sport. But often it's, teenage problems, getting into girls or boys, or getting into drink or drugs. Those types of things, yeah? Those things we should look after.
Yeah. So what was the budget for the UK Olympics again, the British Olympics?
15 billion.
Okay. So if you had 15 billion to spend, aside from a new pair of shoes and a bike.
Probably finish my stairs off.
Maybe put some barriers on your stairs, yeah. What would you invest that in instead of an Olympics? So if you were to look at it and say, right, okay, we've got 15 billion here, we can fix these problems with this money forever. What are those problems you can fix?
Okay. I mean, very simply, each club is run by volunteers. That wouldn't happen anymore. You'd get you'd get to a point where coaches were properly qualified, properly trained and qualified. Mm-hmm. There was an incentive to become a coach. So the level of coaching would be consistent, but also much more knowledgeable, and those coaches would be paid. Yeah. That's the first thing. You'd have more coaches that were paid. We have something extremely unique and beautiful in the UK, which is the club system already has 3 to 4,000 running clubs and 600 dedicated track and field clubs. Right. So maintenance for those track and field clubs, maintenance for the running clubs where they have facilities, that would be all taken care of. You'd have a center of excellences where you'd have hubs for each segment of for each area of the country. So if you're a high performing athlete, you go to a center, and this is something I'm working on at the moment, you go to a center and they could raise your game through elite level coaching. You'd have ambassadors for the sport going around to schools. First of all, you'd do away with 2 hours a week sport. You'd do much more than that. You'd much more than play.
I was going to say, in terms of distribution, is this through government, through education systems more than anything else? Through local government and education?
Yeah, local government education. Which is
what the American system is like, right? So that collegiate system, that exactly does what you just... That problem before of the... 18 to 25 yards that you mentioned, or 18 to 22 yards?
Under 15s, under 20s.
Okay, so 15 to 20 yards is where you get the biggest dropout, yeah? That that five-year gap.
Yep.
What the American system does is absolutely cements a lifetime of sporting interest through those years, because they invest massively. You've seen on TV, right? 80,000 seater stadiums filled completely for a high school NFL game, football game. Yeah, like literally just high school slash university. I'm not sure which is which. They seem to overlap a lot in the US. But that collegiate system seems to be, well, it works. It just works. And not only that, it's an independently standing, commercially driven, revenue driven, profitable aspect of it. So there's no, it's almost as though they, it's how do you describe it? It's like a semi-pro level, but professional in terms of its commercial viability.
Exactly.
So itself. So itself. It supports itself.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And all of these projects have to be sustainable, right? So, this is the thing. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can already look at countries like America that are doing it right at that stage. Yeah. We can already look at football. What's happened at Manchester City? What happened at Barcelona before? We can already look what perfection or close to perfection looks like and do exactly the same. So to look after people right at the start of a career and getting more kids into sport by play is such an obvious thing. I mean the obvious thing is if you say you and me have a discussion about what the world's going to look like in 10 years, then we may come to something that might look somewhere along the lines, yeah, but we really don't know. Based on the last 20, 30 years, we would be guessing, yeah. If you ask an 11-year-old that, then they're not gonna give you an answer. So how can they prepare for the life that they're gonna go into, the career that they're gonna go into? So I think we spend too many hours per week in the British curriculum, and probably all curriculums around the world, many curriculums around the world. We spend too much time learning stuff that we could quickly do a Google search for, right? Learning things that we really don't need to learn, when in actual fact what we need to become good at is problem solving, creative thinking, socializing, presenting, and movement, sport and movement, yeah? And all the lessons you could possibly learn are all in sports, are problem solving, creative thinking, working as a unit, working as a team, resilience, persistence. Kids don't fail these days until it gets too late. Like, you need to fail. You need to know what it's like to lose a game that you wanted to win, to lose a race that you wanted to win. This is so important.
I've got a big issue with that. I this whole kind of, you know, it's the taking part that counts. Not really. I mean, look, taking part's a start. That's the bare minimum requirement to participate in society is taking part, right? And then it's about winning, performance, learning. We have a motto in my house with the kids. It's win or learn. We don't win or lose. Especially with Maddox, who's a huge sore loser, worse than I was. But we have win or learn as a mentality, and that's progressive. You know, this it's the taking part that counts kind of mentality. Not really down with that, and that might be part of it. This kind of everyone's included, and everyone can do everything, and everyone must be pat on the back and put on a pedestal for positive reinforcement. That can also drive mediocrity as well, I think.
Yeah, and I think it comes with, on the back end, it comes with a lot of mental health issues, right? If you've been told you are the most wonderful thing in the world, and then all of a sudden you get to high school and nobody likes you.
Yeah, you're shit.
Yeah, this is the thing. It comes so natural to us as kids. You know, if you put 10 seven-year-olds on a football field and say, right, okay, pick sides, you know, you're going to play. Within 20 minutes, they will have the most competitive game going ever, because they'll switch sides and say, you come over here, you go over there. And it will be obvious. Nobody needs to say anything, but they will know. And you get told, kids tell you, you're not very good at this. And either you raise your game and become better, or you do something else, or you quit. And if you quit, you learn very quickly. I can't keep quitting, otherwise there's going to be nothing left. So, yeah, I think, I don't know, when I look back to, and again, this comes back to your first question about characters in sport, yeah? So we're telling everybody they're wonderful and everybody is inclusive and everybody's a winner and stuff like that. Eventually, you're going to get less characters because you just got a lot of people who think that, you know, that they could do whatever they possibly want. And, you know, like you said, mediocrity is fine. I think it's not. It's really not. And the sooner that people learn that, you know, imagine going for your first job and it's the first time you failed. I didn't get a job. That's
sad. You're going to have problems, psychological problems.
Yeah.
Confidence issues. I mean, this inclusivity thing, I mean, it's obviously been a huge topic in general in society for quite a while now. You know, the world is becoming more liberal year by year. Mm. Is it going too far in some cases? So I noticed recently you interviewed a very interesting person who, well, you tell us. So you interviewed somebody who's a transgender person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's about that person's plight with Feldrunning. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So where do we draw the line in terms of sport and competitive aspects of inclusion? Because obviously the gender conversation is a bigger one, bigger than you and I, and we're not experts on that subject at all. But knowing you, Lee, I'm pretty sure we have very similar opinions on it. But where do we draw a line? So when it comes to people who were born as a male and then end up competing as a female in a female sporting category, that seems like insanity to me, just purely from a biological perspective, from an advantageous perspective, speed, strength, height, muscle mass, bone density, everything, shape, movement, actual movements are different between male and female. That conversation is now becoming more and more prevalent. Mm. There are many examples all over the world where a transgender person has moved from being a biological male to identifying as a female and going on that physical journey as well. But yeah, I saw one example. I think it was an Australian handball player. And she was huge. Like, she was built like a 6'5", huge, strong man against 5'7", strong looking females, but no comparison. And when she threw the ball, like, she was literally knocking people into the net with the ball. It was that powerful. It was just outrageous. I just thought, that can't be real. So I looked into it. But where does this stop? Where does it start?
Well, first of all, That interview was probably the one of the most inspiring that I ever did, because I interviewed Toby, and this is somebody who had very, very open about it, had schizophrenia, was a drug and alcohol addict, had problems with his identity his entire life, born a female, came out to his friends as genderqueer, lost most of his mates, came out then, okay, I'm gonna become a trans guy. Lost vast majority of his mates, and then age 30 joined the trail running or fell running scene in the UK, and for the first time felt fully accepted for who he was. And honestly, it really moved me, and it made me feel proud, probably patriotic for the first time in my life. And I'm very grateful for being born in the UK. Very grateful for being born in Manchester, but patriotism, I don't know, but that made me feel patriotic, and it made me feel proud of the UK athletics club system. It made me feel really proud. So that sent me on a mission to dig up some of the stuff that we just spoke about how you can improve the UK club system, which is a mission of mine. But of course, and also to add to that, actually, Toby was, probably, you know, in the vast majority that he just wants to get on with his life. You know, he doesn't want hassling. He doesn't want people. He just wants people demanding him, but just wants to get on with it. Like the vast majority of every minority, right? But of course, you're going to get the outspoken. But just to answer your question, can you be born a male, switch to female, you know, have a problem with your identity in exactly the same way, switch to female and then get in a cage and start cage fighting somebody or start handball? No, I don't think you should. And I think obviously it's dangerous, and the sport has an obligation to look after the vast majority of the players. So I think it becomes very, very black and white. But then I also have empathy for those people as well, because I mean, obviously, the main cases are the other way around, right? So you wouldn't be able to, if you were born a female and transitioned to male, there may be some, but it probably wouldn't be able to compete at the same level, right? In sport. Whereas if you were born a male and then made the switch and you already had physical capabilities of a male, maybe you would dominate in sport, right? So, but for both, I feel incredible empathy because for the first time in their life, they've probably found something that they like and they're good at and they feel accepted because they're good at, right? And again, they have to get knocked down. Eventually, they're going to have to leave the sport because it's just too... It's not good to watch.
You get some female athletes and competitors who would wipe the floor with most males, right? That's females now. There are a lot more female sports that are more professional, more investment, more higher standards. People can dedicate to it rather than it being part time, as it has been for many years before. And football in particular has only kind of become a true pro sport in the last 10, 15 years, I think. Different stages in different parts of the world, but certainly the wider part. So with those advancements, you do get females that are stronger, faster, better than the majority of males. Like I would have my ass kicked. I'm not a pro athlete in any sport. So you give me a pro female in most sports, she'd probably kick my ass, depending on whatever that was. Okay. Then maybe with one or two exceptions. So there is an overlap, but when you're talking about elitism, And at those extremes, that's where I think it's a whole, okay, there's a line there that is going to be crossed if it's not kind of dealt with in a way that's professional, that is inclusive, but actually there are certain levels of definition. And that's where I think these labels kind of get all blurred when it comes to gender and transgenderism. And I just simplify it quite in my mind, it's just the scientific aspects of the chromosome balance, and then after that.
Yeah, for me, it's very black and white when it comes to that. But then it's crazy how, the public react to stuff and people react to it. It's like if you remember a couple of years ago, it was really hot in the London Marathon. And then, a couple of people died of dehydration or other complications. Yeah, it's usually liver failure or something like that, right? And then all of a sudden, the whole participation in marathons and half marathons and all these recreational events is all of a sudden put under the microscope as if that's the problem. Yeah. Yet you switch on your TV and, like you say, there's a guy playing against girls in. I think it doesn't matter how he identifies. Unfortunately, it is black and white. And does it take somebody to, I mean, this could obviously happen any time in cage fighting because there was some cases. Does it take a death for us to wake up and say, actually, probably wrong there and we shouldn't have done that? And unfortunately it's led to, so I think it's obvious, isn't it?
Well, it feels obvious, but it's still happening. That's my concern. Like society at the moment, mate, is, it's pretty screwed up. When you look at what's going on in America, you look at all these riots and these movements and these, they go under the guise of liberalism, but it feels like Marxism almost, this whole Black Lives Matter movement and how that looks like it's been hijacked and all this kind of cancel culture. There's so much dramatic change in society at the moment and so much uproar about so many topics that this aspect, the question around gender and identity is a big topic. And that this is where kind of societal structures and beliefs and politics filters into sport. And that's happening more now than I've seen in a long time. Like you've got presidents talking about the NFL. You've got, I saw Lewis Hamilton again, just 2 days ago, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix, where he made a stance again for Black Lives Matter. Then he was outspoken that the sport is not doing enough to address racism. Is it a sport's place to address racism? Surely that's a society's place, and sport is just something that occurs within a society. But
do you know what? Like, I had this conversation many times in the last few weeks, and it's obviously topical and things like that. And it matters to me a lot because I think everybody should be. I wish everybody in the world had the same opportunities I had when I grew up. I didn't grow up in a rich family. I grew up with caring parents. My parents are still together. I had all the opportunities in the world in sport, all the opportunities to go to a good primary school, a state school, a good secondary school, state school. And I had all the opportunities in the world to go on and further my education, right? Mm-hmm. And in my career, all the opportunities. So I've been really, I'm really grateful for what I've had. And I wish everybody would have those opportunities. But unfortunately, that's not how the world works. But the way that sport works, and I can speak, I think, a little bit for sport, is it's a meritocracy. So if you're, it doesn't matter where you came from or, you know, what you sound like. If you're a good player, you're going to be on my team, right?
Yeah.
And that's where football, you might say there is racism in sport because listen to the hooligans on. They're not football fans. They're not sports fans. They're just a bunch of idiots that have got nothing else going on in their life. So they need to throw bananas onto the pitch or shout at players who look different to them because they've got no other ammunition. They're idiots, right? So if we say that is football, we're wrong. Like, that's not football. Football, we know, is a beautiful game. And this happens in all over the world in different other sports as well, yeah? That's not the way it is, right? When I went to South Africa, I'd heard about South Africa. I heard about the racial tension. I had read about apartheid and watched documentaries and seen...
Why films. Were you there?
For the Comrades Marathon last year.
Comrades.
Yeah. And most famous and the biggest ultra marathon in the world, 25,000 people. And I got there, as soon as I landed, tense. Even in the airport, tense. There's a difference. We hang out over here, you hang out over there, right? And then they hear your voice and it's like, oh, okay, he's actually not South Africa. He's actually a white guy from another place. He's sound. And, you know, and you know, obviously, like, you're with athletes. So you think, okay, sport's going to cut through all this. There was still a divide at the breakfast table, at the lunch table, yeah? So I would make a point of going sitting with black athletes. And, you know, I could see that maybe that wasn't the right thing to do. I could see that, you know, but
is no, it not?
In my mind, it's the right thing to do. But people didn't like it.
Is there an etiquette there then? Is there an etiquette aspect that
must be? And
just an actual divide? Sorry, mate. Just
there is a divide. Yeah, there is a divide, and you know, where I was in Durban, it wasn't a safe place. You know, a couple of times people tried to run me over as I was running on the road. When I run on the road and there's no pavement, I run so I'm facing the traffic. And for a lot of drivers, obviously, that might be strange. But, you know, I want the final say whether I'm going to die or not. I want that last second opportunity to jump into a bush, right? And a couple of times people came into my didn't try to move away, came into my direction. I only went for two runs. Yeah, that's happened to me maybe four times in my life, twice in literally 2 days in South Africa. There's a divide. But the most beautiful thing was on the race day, all that went away. All that just dissipated. And it became like the one, and it from the start line, I had the hairs on my neck standing up because everybody's together. And you're just like... we're all together. We're all doing sport. You're a runner. I'm a runner. Let's be friends. It's that 3-4-year-old mentality that you have that you like Star Wars. I like Star Wars. We're best mates, right? And then as I'm running the race, and I'm knackered and tired. These four big black girls shout to me, "Go on, white boy!" And I was like, "This is absolutely awesome." I am all that was literally just a day ago. It's just perfect today. And so it was like, it was almost like an amnesty day where we're together. And when I finished and so you're celebrating with the crowd and stuff like that. And it's like, whoa, white guy did well. And that's how they still talk in South Africa, right?
Where did you come?
12th. Don't want to talk about
it. In your first one?
Don't want to talk about it.
And how far off the lead?
11 places. No, so like my intention for that race was to go in and win it, yeah. Not gonna make any excuses, but I need to do better next time. But I think 20 minutes off the lead or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which really, from in terms of pacing, is not a huge difference over the course of, it's 100 kilometers, right?
It's 89 kilometers.
89.
Yeah. Okay. But it's a brilliant race. It's like one year it's up to St. Peter's Maritzburg and one year it's down and it finishes in the stadium. So I went up because I prefer uphill running. Unbelievable event. But that's the thing. And this is the thing with Toby as well. It doesn't matter. I don't care what your sexual preferences or what your gender. All these things don't matter. What matters is you like to run. Therefore, you're in the club. Yeah. And and that's for me the beauty of sport as well. That's another lesson that it teaches, inclusivity, but meritocracy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can come and play with us. But if you're rubbish, you're going to have to find a different league because that's how it works.
That meritocracy thing, I think, is beautiful in sport, right? It's just even keel. Everyone's on the same playing field.
Yeah.
And you're right about the opportunity stuff as well. I think for me, it's more, I think the racism we see in sport is either systemic in terms of some of the old school nature of some sports and some of the control of certain parties and bodies and whatnot. Almost like an old boys club in some ways. And that's, I'm talking about UK sports in particular, and there's probably three or four that come to mind, but I think the future, the next generation and that generation change of leadership in the sport, I think you'll start to see a huge change. And I do think that when you see racism manifest itself in sport, it's often a societal problem, not a sport problem. My issue has been using sport to push certain narratives, especially on this Black Lives Matter thing. I've got a real beam on it about this at the moment. It's like, well, it feels so blatantly obvious that this is being used as a political play in the States that is being pushed around the world under the guise, under the premise of a noble movement. Those three words, Black Lives Matter, they're undeniable. Okay. No one can argue with that. And yet when you see some of the rioting and the violence and the deaths and, the links to Marxism and whatnot, it just seems, well, actually, this isn't a racial justice movement. This is a political movement. And that's my issue. When you start to take on political, narratives or political causes and you start to bring that into your sport, that's where it's a little bit like, let's just leave sport as sport and let's leave the politics out of it.
Yeah. I don't know. I like to think that politics has no place in sport. But of course, forever and a day, politics has been involved in sport. And, if we just look back to the Berlin Olympic Games in 1934 or something like that, 1932, I can't remember because I wasn't alive. How powerful is that? Jesse Owens winning how many events, like 100, 200, 400 long jump in front of Hitler. It's like, how about that? And then I think he left the stadium. There's no more powerful message than that. Can you do anything about it? No, you can't. See you later. I'm going back to America with my gold medals. Ciao. Enjoy yourself. Good luck with the war. And that would be like, that for me, you could say also sport is war without bullets. And the way I compete is like, if you can match me stride for stride and we finish together, I swear to God, I have no more respect for any other people because I know what I do in order to get to the level that I tried to get to in ultra running. Yeah. And I have my niche that I'm good at. So I know how hard I work. And I know I don't like to call it sacrifice, but many people would call it sacrifice. I know, we were the best men at our mate's wedding. Right. And I didn't drink. Right. How many times is that going to happen in your life? And you actually have the opportunity to enjoy the night and stuff like that. So the sacrifices I make, I live in different places to get better. So if you can match me toe for toe and beat me or just lose to me, I have ultimate respect. And I don't care where you're from, like what you do, whatever, what sort of culture, what your political mind is. I don't care. You have my respect. It's as simple as that. But the interesting point about this for me is Netflix is an interesting one, and comedy is one of my favorite pastimes, to sort of watch comedy.
What are your favorite pastimes?
Yeah. To be involved in and to watch and to watch. So, but this is the great thing, because Chris Rock said a few years ago that the problem now is everybody's got a camera in the pocket, right? So you do this, you try risky material, and this is how you have to do it. Yeah, you try risky material out in a small venue, and some idiot films it and sticks it on YouTube 20 seconds later, out of context. This guy said this, and therefore, and this was happening quite a lot. So they've got to a point now where they've had to say, here you go, there's a locker for everybody who comes in, put your phone in there, no recording material, anybody who records, this is fine, etc. Big deterrence. That's how it's had to go. But Netflix has gone one step further and said, push the boundaries. Comedy is meant to dance around risky subjects, yeah? It's meant to give you a shock factor. So dance around those subjects. So when I spoke to Toby, I was like, listen, I'm just interested, right? Because I messed up with a couple of things. I said, I grew up in Manchester, so I'm familiar with the LGBT. I was like, what the fuck are the letters? I don't know. Like, I don't know. And I said, sorry, I don't know the letters. Like, I'm sorry, I'm ignorant. Tell me. He was like, yeah, it's all right, everybody. And then we laughed about it. And that would be, he would be one of my mates if I lived where he was. He's a sound guy, witty, you know, on the ball, smart. And then I said, I'm interested. Like, Dave Chappelle does a bit on this LGBTQ bus, right? What do you think about that? And he was like, I think comedy's great. I think comedy's great for literally getting that message out there. I think it's the perfect place. And I love that comedians are pushing things further and further, because we should laugh at these things. And it's only if we come to a stage in society where the minority, literally, what you know that person we used to grow up with, who would write to the BBC and say, I was deeply offended by the episode of Only Fools. Who are those people? Come out and show your face, you fool. Yeah. Because, like, this is, who's got the time to do that?
Everyone has Twitter now, right?
Yeah, get your clicker, just go, different channel, really solved, problem solved, yeah? But no, I'll watch the whole thing and then gather up all... Unbelievable, yeah? These people should be round up and shot. That's my view. That's what, I mean, you know, I'm... Yeah, if Kanye's running, I'll run. That's my view, yeah.
I think Kanye is having some mental problems by the sounds of some things, mate. So you and him might get on just fine.
But the point is, we cannot move at the slowest person's pace all the time. That is not how evolution works. And we're doing the opposite, right? So we can't move at the slowest person's pace. That's the thing in society. Don't waste people's time. If you like going slow, walking or driving or pedaling your bike, move out of the way. Just move to the side. We'll go around you. No problem at all. Yeah. If I'm slower than the guy behind me, sorry, mate, just get past. Perfect metaphor for life. Don't get in anyone's way. Yeah, just be happy, do your own thing, mind your own business, let people do their thing. Simple as that.
Like that.
Shouldn't get more difficult than that, I don't think.
Metaphor for life, don't get in people's way, do your own thing.
Do your own thing, make yourself happy, and don't get in anybody's way.
All right. What's next for Lee Grantham? What are you working on, mate?
What I want to do is... I want to set the world record in 100K. I want to modernize the UK athletics club system.
Talk to me about the world record. So what's the world record right now?
The world record right now is 6 hours, 10 minutes.
And you are at?
6 hours, 42 minutes.
Okay.
So I can run 4 minutes per kilometer. Yeah. The world record is 3:42 per kilometer.
So you're 18 seconds per kilometre off.
Yep.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, really, is it? But I know it is. When it's at this level, it's fine margins. But how long before you can get near that, roughly?
Yeah.
What's your goal?
I'd say I'm preparing for a race now, which is 50K uphill. After that, I'm going to prepare either for a marathon or the 100K. So the training, although it's pretty similar, there are some differences. And you can't train for a marathon, for instance, and then go for the 100K. It doesn't work like that. You've got to, although it's similar to training, it's the parts that are different are important to hit. So I can do that within, I can have a crack at that within 6 to 12 months. Probably even before. Yeah. And
what kind of preps are you then? So you're a chunk off now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're getting faster, which is one thing. Mm. And I think that performance in the comrades as well, like coming that high up first time, especially the uphill one. I think that's fucking awesome, quite frankly. And so what are you going to do differently then? So what does that training look like to get to world record standard?
Yeah, it's a good question. So you need to, this probably happened to me with after lockdown, right? So after sort of COVID, March, April, if you would have asked me before COVID, how long can you be competitive for? I probably would have said, probably until I'm about 40. And it would have been a conveniently nice number. And people who come to me for coaching, they always seem to aim for a conveniently nice number, like sub 3 hours marathon or sub 4 hours marathon or sub 45 minutes 10K. Everything's a round number, yeah? And so I was aimless, really, with 40. Yeah, it's rubbish. So what I need to do is look under the bonnet. And what I've been doing for the last 4 months is look under the bonnet. So I need to look at my the way I train. Yeah, I need to look at the strength and conditioning that I do. I need to look at my nutrition. My nutrition is good, but it's not brilliant. It needed to be brilliant, and it's now a lot better. Yeah, which means my recovery is a lot better, which means I can train hard a lot more often. I need to my nutrition during the race, that needs to raise my game. My psychology is simple. My psychology is solid, yeah? But it can still, I know why I'm motivated now, because I've spoken to so many people in these different fields during lockdown, because it was an opportunity to speak to people because everybody was at home, yeah? So I spoke to lots of people in these different fields. And say you've got six fields, right? Biomechanics is another. Biomechanics, the way you move over the ground, yes. So the way I run, that needs improving. Say all of those is 1%, right? That's 6% moving forward. That would achieve my total already. Psychologically, I'm already better than 4 minutes per kilometer. So I already, if I would have run that race where I did 6:42, ran that race in 3:55s, I would have achieved it pretty easy, maybe even 3:50. But let's say 3:55. So I think I'm 12 seconds per kilometer away, not 17 seconds, right? Or 18 seconds.
So you had something left in the tank when you finished?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so, wow. Okay. So then, because you can't, like a marathon, you can't run the first half and then all of a sudden speed up by 10 minutes in the second half. It doesn't happen. Yeah. It has to be really evenly paced, yeah, for your energy systems and everything. So if I say 6% improvement, so at the moment, 4 minutes is 240 seconds, yeah? So 6% would be, you're good at maths.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So 10 seconds. Yeah. 6% would be 10 seconds. So then let's say, but actually what those 1%, you exponentially get better, because once each one of those gets better, it improves the other part. So once your nutrition improves, your strength and conditioning gets better, you get stronger. Once your strength and conditioning gets stronger, your biomechanics improve because you're able to stride further. So then you start to say, right, actually, this has gone from possible to probable. It's just a case of picking the course, picking the day, and having the good conditions. That's something you can't I'm going to have a go at this and then go for it. It needs to be absolutely all in. Yeah. So that's the first goal. And then I want to get faster in the marathon and get faster in the 50K and then win some big racing, set some course records in some of the big races around the world. But then I want to improve the club system in the UK. I want to modernize the club system based on what we just spoke. That's a really big passion of mine.
Focus on running, the running club system.
Yeah, the running club system. So when I grew up in the same town as you, we had three cricket clubs, countless football clubs, athletics stadium 2 miles down the road, yeah? Opportunity galore. And I think every kid should have, like my coach, a guy who rocks up every Tuesday and Thursday night and Saturday morning for free. That shouldn't happen. That guy should be rewarded for that, because he's having a massive effect on a lot of people's lives. Yeah. Not just as children. I still appreciate that. Like, 30 years later, right? So yeah. These people, they should be totally modernized, right? And there should be an incentive to become a coach, raise the bar. So I want to improve all that, and then I want to climb big mountains.
Oh, wow. I don't know about the mountain stuff. So step one is build a bigger profile for yourself in the running scene.
Yeah, I suppose if you break the world record, you get a bigger profile as well, yeah? So it makes everything easier.
And then, yeah, exactly. Then you can use that profile to tackle some of the issues at grassroots level sports in the UK, especially in running clubs.
Exactly that.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And you are, I know we spoke just briefly as well before the show, but you're looking into a documentary at the moment as well on your quest for the world record. How are you getting on with that?
Yeah, it's going really well. It's going really well. It's sort of a new world for me. I've done commercials and things like that before. So putting all this together and making all the things align is difficult, especially now during COVID times because of travel restrictions and movement restrictions in the country. That sort of industry, there's so much logistics. And I'm such an impatient person. It's like, why don't we do this tomorrow? It's like, well, I'm free, you're free. But obviously there's a lot of planning needs to go into it. And it needs to be like really good in order to be something that can be used time and time again. It needs to compete with other things. So yeah, it's exciting. And it's, I'm passionate about it.
Well, this is where it becomes what we talked about before in terms of character in sport. This becomes a perfect platform for showing that and inspiring people. So mate, good luck with it. Good luck with the world record attempts. Good luck with the documentary. I'll be keeping a close eye on it. And thank you for your time. I really appreciate catching up. And
yeah,
let's do it again.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Cheers. Listeners, you've been listening to Fearless Thought. This is Jamie Wilkes with Lee Grantham. See you next time.